You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It can be a terrible dilemma. Here you've spent a lot of time cooking a delicious dish, then you have to figure out what wine to pair it with. Do you choose an old favorite, something you already have on hand, or do you have to go and buy something at the last minute that the guy in the wine shop says will go with it? Well, Eric Asimov and Florence Fabricant have devoted much of their careers to what they think of as this delicious dilemma, and they have shared their accumulated wisdom with us in a book that's chock-a-block with recipes, sidebars, and encouragement. It's called Simply Wine with Food, just out from Rizzoli. Eric Asimov has been chief wine critic at the New York Times since 2004. Florence Fabricant, who has written 10 cookbooks, contributes weekly columns to the New York Times. I'm delighted that both of them could be with us again. Thank you so much for coming back.
Great to be here.
Were there times in the past when you had trouble pairing food with wine?
You know, I think one of the important things about this book is to get across a message that it's not a dilemma. It's actually a wonderful opportunity to try different wines with different foods. I think we have to take the fear out of this.
Well, do you remember, Florence, the first time that you suddenly understood what wine can do with food?
I was too young. No, I think the whole idea of dilemma, when you talk about you've made this dish and you now what wine do you put with it, I think if you step back and think of going to a restaurant where you're a party of four and everybody's ordered something different and you need one bottle of wine, and if you pick a bottle of wine that's in your price range that sounds like it ought to be pretty good, and for the most part, it'll go with everything.
Well, often what you wind up with if you have some people having chicken, fish, beef, whatever, is a Pinot Noir.
Exactly.
What the sommelier says will go with them all.
Yeah, it often does. But there are other choices in that direction.
Especially if you're in an Italian restaurant, it's not going to work.
Well, what kind of interaction don't they just call it Pinot Nero?
Pinot Nero, but you almost never see it.
What kind of interaction should you be looking for? Is there some chemical thing that makes certain wines go better with certain foods?
You know, we have these charts, schematics, and so on, and we make this issue so complicated, so needlessly complicated. You know, the most important thing about wine and food is just getting in the habit of doing it. And eventually you learn what goes with what. It's not just one. Any one dish will have a dozen wines that goes with it.
Yeah.
And Florence, you say that we should consider the 100 wines that you've paired with 100 dishes as suggestions.
That's correct.
Interchangeable and forgiving.
Yes. Yeah. And what often is a good way to think about it is the temperature of the wine, because sometimes that will affect your enjoyment with certain dishes. And I'm saying even to enjoy a bottle of red wine cool, order a Beaujolais, and you'd be surprised how well it goes with fish.
So some red wines, even though we've been told you cool the white wine and you don't cool the red wine, some red wines are better cooled?
Well,
yes,
I think
most.
You know, we have our temperature backwards often. We serve good white wine too cold because that can mask all the nuances.
Because really cold really kills some of the flavor, doesn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. And it's a great thing to do with bad wine. You just make it so cold that it's a chilly pleasure and you don't taste the wine. But red wine, conversely, we serve too warm generally, and that makes it a little bit flat. If we can get it to just a very light chill, you know, when they talk about room temperature, it's back when rooms had thick stone walls and it was winter.
And no central heat.
Right.
Same thing true for beer, isn't it? A good beer, you don't want to drink frigid cold.
I believe that.
Yeah,
I think the English have something right where beer is concerned.
Eric, you say it's really hard to make a mistake.
I think so, yeah.
So pretty much any wine will go with any meal?
No,
there must be sometimes when it doesn't work.
Not any wine with any meal, but I think the chances are that if you're going to be in the ballpark, You know, you see people in restaurants going to great pains, tasting dozens of wine with a particular dish to get it right. And they should, because you're paying a lot of money for that, and these are experts. But, you know, choosing a wine at home is like cooking at home. You don't want to get over anxious about it. You don't have to be so perfectionistic.
But people, Florence, are looking for some kind of magical interaction.
Well, there are certain things you can do. For example, I believe in using good wine in your sauce when you're cooking and then thinking about serving that same wine. And that, you asked me about an experience. I remember back in, many years ago at the Four Seasons restaurant when Seppi Rengli was the chef, and we had ordered a Pinot Noir from Acacia in California, and we ordered pheasant. And the pheasant came out in a wine sauce, and it matched so beautifully, and it turns out the chef used the same wine.
But you hadn't known that when you ordered the wine.
No.
Now, there are people who will tell you that when you're cooking with wine, that if you're going to cook for a while, it doesn't really matter whether you use a good wine or a bad wine. It's only when you're going to finish the dish with a wine where it matters. You don't agree? Once you cook the alcohol out, doesn't that pretty much take all the quality out?
No, I think you still have the flavor. You still have the flavor, and it becomes less important. But I think as a benchmark to consider serving the wine you're cooking with is helpful.
I think you don't want to use too good a wine in cooking because, in a way, that's a waste. You want to make sure you're using a sound wine. You know, one that's not flawed or tainted somehow. But I don't think there's a chef anywhere who will make beef in Barolo, in actual Barolo.
My guests are Eric Asimov and Florence Fabricant. They both appear every Wednesday in the New York Times, and they've put a book together, collaborated on a book called Wine with Food, Pairing Notes and Recipes from the New York Times. Eric, what makes you say that we're living in the greatest time in history to drink wine?
Because we have more choices among wines than ever before. If you go to a corner wine shop here in New York City, you're seeing wines from great wines from Sicily, from Eastern Europe, from the Finger Lakes of New York, from every continent but Antarctica. And these are not just, it's not just saying that these places make wines. They're making really good wines, interesting wines, distinctive wines.
Although some of the old timers will tell you that wines have gotten too similar these days because of the power of a couple of wine critics.
You know, that might have been true 10 or 15 years ago, but I think people have realized the joy in differences, in distinctiveness. Now, because of this realization, that's why we have all of these wonderful wines. It's not that the Italians are trying to make every wine taste like Cabernet. Now we're seeing the great wealth of wines that Italy has produced
because they have more grapes than practically any other place in the world in that little country.
And they're using them. This trend to go back to native grapes and to see what's being done with them is quite amazing. It's good.
Well, I just came back from a trip to Italy, and one of the people there said, "Well, if you can, try to have the wine where the grapes were grown right next to the vegetables you're having that night for dinner." That's not always possible. And in this country, of course, I live in Greenpoint. I don't know whether any wines are or vegetables are grown near me.
I bet they are on rooftops.
Well, can't we have too many choices? Can't it be a little intimidating?
Well, it's more than intimidating. It's paralyzing sometimes. And I think that's, you mentioned before, sometimes you have to stop at the last minute at the shop and ask the guy for a recommendation for what goes with dinner. I think that's a great idea. I think you should find a good wine shop and talk to the people who work there. They often know those wines better than somebody who's writing for a magazine, you know, hundreds of miles away and tastes hundreds of wines at a time.
Although if you go to a good restaurant and you tell the sommelier that you want something that would be interesting with this, the odds are you're going to wind up with a wine you'll never see in a wine shop.
That may be, but you'll have a great experience.
Yeah. But actually, when I'm tasting wines on the wine panel, I start to think about food right away. And the idea of what I think would go with a particular wine starts to formulate in my head and on my palate.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the wine panel. The two of you are regular participants in those wine tasting panels for the Wednesday Times food section. Do you find yourself generally agreeing with each other?
Maybe half the time, which means we disagree half the time.
Yeah. And when we have, because there are two guests as well, and when you put those into the mix, very often you don't get a consensus on any given wine.
You know, this
so one of you can think that this is a fabulous wine and the other one doesn't like it?
You know, wine taste is very subjective, as with anything else, music, film, and so on. So, you know, just because you don't like a wine doesn't mean it's a bad wine. And conversely, just because you have a great wine in front of you doesn't mean you have to like it.
Well, Florence, you said you're immediately thinking about pairing the wine with something. When you are cooking a special meal, does the wine come first? Do you say, okay, I have this wine I really want to serve for my guests. What should I make? Or do you think of the dish and then think of what wine you might want to pair with it?
Well, it depends on the rest of the people that I've invited for dinner, because I don't want to waste great wine on people who could care less. So if these are wine lovers, I will definitely start with the wine.
Well, I have a friend who says he has some incredible wines in his house, but nobody's ever been good enough who's come to dinner for him to open them up. And at this point, they may be over the hill.
He better check the actuarial tables.
So what was the process of working on a book like this together, since you don't always agree?
Well, in this case, Florence did the recipes, and I did most of the text. And I think Florence's recipes are terrific. On that, we agree.
Yeah. But we sorted through – I mean, I think it was a meeting of the minds, sorting through all of the possible wines that Eric could discuss. And we agreed on the list up to a point. There were some that I felt maybe should have been included, and there are others he included that I said, well. But at the end of the day, that was basically his organization, and then the recipes went along with.
But you were already working on the recipes.
Well, the recipes, yeah.
Now, one of the problems a lot of people have when they first become interested in wines is reading about wines, because those descriptions can be rather confusing. There's a whole language of wine that goes way above me. When I read it has a taste of saddle, I don't know. I've never tasted saddle, and I'm not sure I even want to taste saddle.
Well, I think those descriptions are pernicious in some ways. I mean, they drive people away. They make people anxious, because nobody experiences wine like that unless you're stuck in a room with Klieg lights and 100 bottles and you've got to think of something to write. I think it's imperative, rather than reading about it, you've got to drink wine and find out whether it's something that interests you enough to want to read about it.
One of the things you say here is that you should consider the weight of the wine when you're trying to pair it with food. What do you mean by that?
Well, actually, there are richer, heavier wines, and there are lighter, more frivolous wines, both in the red and the whites. And with big, rich dishes like beef at Barolo, you want a big, rich wine. You don't want a wine that's going to disappear alongside.
That's more likely in the wintertime, isn't it?
Well, even in the summertime that works, because if you take a lobster is a pretty rich piece of meat, and you don't want another, you know, something light and ephemeral to go alongside.
Or it's, you know, people are grilling steaks or sausages. That's not rosé food. But, it becomes instinctive after a while. It's like choosing clothing for the weather. You pick lighter things in hot weather, or you pick lighter wines to go with more delicate foods.
So you can have heavy red wines, but you also can have heavy white wines, can't you?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Chardonnay, it's a heavy white wine.
Although it can be light.
It depends where it comes from and the intent of the winemaker. And these are things you learn over time.
My guests are Eric Asimov and Florence Fabricant. Their book, Wine with Food, Pairing Notes and Recipes from the New York Times. It is published by Rissoli. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Eric Asimov and Florence Fabricant. Mr. Asimov has been chief wine critic at the New York Times since 2004, and he's the author of How to Love Wine, a memoir and manifesto. And Florence Fabricant has been contributing regularly to the New York Times for how many years, Florence?
I lost count.
She is the author of 10 cookbooks, including the New York Restaurant Cookbook and Park Avenue Potluck. And they have collaborated on a book called Wine with Food, Pairing Notes and Recipes from the New York Times, published by Rizzoli. And I assume this comes out of the fact that you've been working together on these tasting panels for how many years now?
Gosh, it's...
Over 10.
Yeah, I think it's 12 years now.
Yeah.
Now, you organize the book... you start off with... Prosecco / sparklers. Most people would say champagne / Prosecco sparklers, no?
Well, there is an entry on champagne, but we started originally lighter to heavier, and things may have gotten a little bit mixed up.
Now, Prosecco is not made the same way champagne is made.
No.
Is it?
You know, Prosecco tends to be made in vast quantity and made in big tanks and doesn't require the same sort of meticulous care as champagne. And it's a lighter, more frivolous, I like silly wines.
The bubbles are bigger. It's not as refined, but it has fun.
Yeah.
It's fun.
Yeah.
And different grapes altogether.
And does it go with any food? They say champagne goes with any food.
Well, I think that charcuterie and sparkling wines, which regardless of what the sparkling wine is a terrific matching, because most good sparkling wines have some acidity, sometimes piercing acidity, and that helps to compete with the fat in your charcuterie.
The other great match is fried chicken. With champagne. It's kind of counterintuitive because we think
that's
of champagne.
High and low.
Yeah, we think of champagne as being very elegant and urbane, but fried chicken, fried foods, sushi, it goes with all kinds of things. We've got to take champagne away from the white tie people and bring it back to the people.
But there are so many different places that make wines in the champagne method.
Every wine region has its sparkling wine.
Do you like Californians, Spanish, Italian, Northern Italian?
I think good cava, the sparkling wine of Spain, can be one of the best deals around. It's very inexpensive, but unlike Prosecco, it's made with the same method as champagne. You have to have two fermentations rather than... one, and it's of course different grapes than champagne, but it can be very elegant itself, very light.
The bottle says Method Champenoise. That means it's made like champagne,
exactly.
Even though it isn't made in the champagne area.
Although, to be honest, and I'm a little foggy on the rules right now, but the Champenoise may guard that slogan. I'm not sure everybody is permitted to use it.
I think
they
can, yeah,
okay.
The method. But the interesting thing that I've found lately, and I think it's kind of a new trend, what are called crémants in French. Sparkling wines from different regions have gotten so much better in the last few years that I seek them out.
May I say one more thing about sparkling wines? One of my favorites is not even white. It's red. Lambrusco.
Used to be the wine that wine snobs would definitely have avoided. But that's
because we weren't getting good
Lambruscos.
No, we were just getting this kind of candied concoction that was marketed here and sold millions and still does, by the way. But now we have access to these wonderful traditional Lambruscos from Emilia-Romagna. And this is one of the reasons why this is such a wonderful time for wine.
Listeners wonder what kind of a price point for a good wine? Let's say one of the inexpensive sparklers. Can I get a good one for $10, $15?
$10, maybe not. $15 for sure.
Yeah.
$20, you have a lot of choices. That's kind of the sweet spot right now for quality and value.
Florence, for sparkling wines, you include a recipe for souffled crab meat canapes.
Mm-hmm.
You beat egg whites, then fold them into the crab meat, and then whisk the egg yolks separately. And why does that go well with a sparkling wine?
Well, first of all, with the beaten egg whites, to me, the froth that you get there seemed to demand a sparkling wine. Plus, it's kind of an hors d'oeuvre. Most of the recipes that I've put with sparkling wines are for dishes that are not your main course. And therefore, it's something that you can serve as a tidbit.
There, some of the nicest champagnes are actually rosé champagnes. And for years, it was my sense that wine, what word do I want to use, wine snobs, look down on rosés. But rosés can be some of the most wonderful wines that you could ever want to drink.
Well, I would say that rosé champagne may be my least favorite champagne because I usually find it to be a little bit heavier than other champagnes. But rosés in general, I've had this remarkable popularity over the last decade. And, you know, it's almost... I think the industry is a little bit cynical about it. They'll rush anything out in the summer and call it rosé, and it doesn't have to be very good to sell.
And why the summer? Because it's seen as a refreshing wine for the hot weather?
It's seen as a hot weather wine. It's an outdoor wine, a light, unserious wine.
Chilled.
You don't have to be critical about it. I mean, I personally feel there are great rosés that you can drink year-round, and you shouldn't pigeonhole it for the summer, but...
And you suggest a lobster spaghetti with fresh tomatoes with a rosé, Florence.
Because the lobster spaghetti, to me, it's a dish that you could actually even serve at room temperature. And rosé goes terrifically with it, although you could drink a white, you could drink a red. But anything you drink with that dish, I think, should be a little cool.
Well, you say you can drink a white, you can drink a red. There are certain rules that we have heard over the years. White wine goes with fish.
You know, that's a good rule to keep in mind, but there are so many exceptions to it. Pinot Noir with salmon is a wonderful combination, or
in
Beaujolais.
Fact, if you visit a Bordeaux chateau, very often they will serve salmon.
Or, you know,
the
classic Bordeaux dish, lamprey with in red wine.
The reason that usually... white wine is usually suggested is because fish has such a subtle taste and you don't want to overwhelm it
with
a big red
wine.
Well,
it's a good rule of thumb if you're going to have a very delicate fish, flounder or something like that. You might not choose a red wine. A white wine might be better. But, you know, these are rules that are not meant to be binding. They're just meant to guide people who, as we say before, might be paralyzed with indecision.
But if you have a wonderful wine in the house, it's a red, and you're serving fish, it's okay.
It's fine. It's fine. And if conversely, if you think about white wines, Rieslings from Germany, the Germans drink those wines with everything.
Well, but Rieslings range from totally dry, the Trockens, to half dry, Halbtrocken, to sweeter, and sweetest. And they can be very expensive, can't they? The sweet ones, anyway.
They can get there, yeah. But the less sweet wines, the dry wines, are among the most reasonably priced wines there are. And Riesling's incredibly versatile with food.
For many years, I was told that you should only drink red wines with cheeses. And then more recently, I read maybe you should only drink white wines with cheeses. What's going on there?
Well, I've long believed that white wine is better with cheese than red. There, between the fat and the salt and the cheese, it dumbs down a good red wine, number one. And number two, the acidity in white wine cuts the fat in the cheese, just as the sparkling wine with charcuterie, the same thing operates on the cheese level. And yes, there are cheeses with a Parmigiano Reggiano, maybe you'll want red wine. But with a lot of cheeses, I think you're better off with a white.
Conversely, you don't want to just eliminate the entire notion of red wine with cheese. I mean, there are some red wines that will go well with cheese. Yeah. And then very often at the end of a meal, that's what you're left with, red wine. And there's no reason to open a new bottle of white wine because you've heard that you shouldn't drink red wine with cheese.
But when we say white wine, for example, I think, well, that could be a Chardonnay, that could be a Sauvignon Blanc, that could be a Riesling, that could be a Pinot Grigio. We can go on. There's all sorts of grapes in Spain and Italy with names that I can't even remember. So what are we talking about there? Do we have to be as conscious of the weight that we mentioned earlier, or the fact that some taste more citrusy than others, others taste more fruity when we're making these decisions?
Well, I think you have to really look to find a wine you like. And once you've done that, you've done more than 50% of the work. Because if you find a wine you like, chances are you're going to enjoy your meal if the food is any good. And it isn't a mystery of any kind.
And, you know, I hate to use technical terms talking about wine, but
okay.
Usually cheese is fatty, and you want something, as Florence said, to cut through that fat. So acidic wines tend to be very good. And I also like a lot of sweet wines with cheese.
Pungent cheeses.
Yeah. You know, the classic is Roquefort and Sauternes.
Which is very sweet.
Which is sweet.
Not as sweet as you think. With sweet wines, they call them dessert wines. My feeling is a lot of sweet wines you have instead of dessert. You'd be surprised how much sweeter most desserts, like a tarte tatin with a sauterne, the sauterne's sweetness almost disappears on your palate. So if you're serving dessert with a sweet wine, a dessert wine, the sugar in that dessert should be very restrained.
We, by the way, have some of the recipes that Florence Fabricant has put into this book on our show page at WNYC.org. So if this conversation has inspired you to think about pairing wines with foods, just go to our show page at WNYC.org. We're talking about Wine with Food. That's the name of the book written by Eric Asimov and Florence Fabricant, Pairing Notes and Recipes from the New York Times. It's published by Rizzoli. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Littlebait. Suddenly we see new grapes introduced. They're not new in
Europe.
They're ancient. Like Gruner Veltliner suddenly became very popular. Is it because wine importers are being more daring today than they were in the past?
I think that is a part of it, but they're also looking for things that haven't been done, and they have an audience here that is willing to experiment, that is not shocked by something that they don't know.
Yeah.
I think that's a great thing. There's still so much to discover.
There are these tiny little regions in Spain that have grapes like Rueda and Godello that you may not have heard of, and yet they're very well priced and worth knowing.
Of course, you could buy a bottle by a lousy producer and think, well, I don't like that kind of wine.
You could, but if you follow good importers, they've done a lot of the work, the editing work of getting rid of the lousy wine. So
so trust the name on the bottle that says imported by so-and-so?
That's a very simple way of negotiating the vast choices. If you find that your taste coincides with a particular importer and you see that name on the back of a bottle, that's a very good indication that you may like that wine.
A wine that has been popular, then lost popularity, and now I think is popular again is Chateauneuf du Pape. Florence, you chose a hearty pea soup to go with this very expensive wine.
Well, that was a restaurant experience. I had ordered that particular soup and perused the wine list and liked the choice of a particular Chateauneuf du Pape, and So we ordered that, and I did think it went very well. There's a fair amount of bacon in that soup.
A whole pound slab.
Yeah. And there are sometimes some vegetal notes you'll get in the blend of 13 some odd different grapes they use in Chateauneuf-du-Pape, so it picks up everything.
And I will say from personal experience, that's a wonderful recipe for pea soup.
You have to skim off the foam. Where does the foam come from?
As it cooks. You know, like when you make chicken soup, there's always that foam as it simmers that rises to the top. And I just like clean soup. My mother always told me you have to have clean soup.
You also use bay leaves in this. Bay leaves are put into many different recipes. You have to discard them because they can kill you. But
yeah.
What role do bay leaves play in a recipe?
It's a highly aromatic herb, and it adds both fragrance and flavor. It brings the flavor into much more of the sphere of kind of an earthiness that you don't get with a lot of other herbs. It's serious herb.
But don't eat it. Another grape that we're seeing a lot of is Malbec, coming from Argentina. Now, Malbec is a French grape, and why don't the French make more Malbecs?
Well, you know, at the end of the 19th century, there was an infestation of aphids that killed off most of the vineyards in Europe. And when they replanted the vineyards, Malbec was one of a half dozen or so grapes grown in Bordeaux. When they replanted the vineyards, they didn't replant Malbec because it was one of the more difficult grapes to grow there. And it, you know, it largely kind of faded away until it hit it big in Argentina.
Is it easier to grow in Argentina?
Definitely.
Apparently.
Yeah. I was in Malbec country about a year ago, and they talked about that and how the climate and the terroir, which in Mendoza, it's fairly desert climate, is the Malbec is much happier because it's not as prone to fungal infections and that kind of thing, which it was in Bordeaux.
Of course, you have to be very aware of where the wine comes from, not just the grape, because a Sauvignon Blanc from New Zealand is very different than one from Bordeaux, very different from one in Sancerre.
Well,
or
you know, this is
the
issue of terroir that you'll hear wine people talk about endlessly, but it really exists. And the classic example is Chablis, which is made with the Chardonnay grape, and yet a real Chablis from France tastes like no other Chardonnay in the world. And as hard as people may try, they can't make a Chardonnay anywhere else taste like Chablis.
It's the chalk and the soil.
But there has to be similar soil in other places.
I think it's the soil, it's the particular climate, the elevation, and it's the community that produces the wine. And you add all of this together, and you get a very specific taste and quality that goes with that wine.
Go ahead, Florence.
Thinking about wine nowadays, with the kind of expertise you have on with wine, and you go to California and they grow every grape under the sun. I think that today, if the French wanted to grow, make Chardonnay in Bordeaux, which they don't, they could do a fine Chardonnay, but tradition also drives
this.
Well,
there are rules in France, aren't there? You can't grow Chardonnay in Bordeaux.
No, you can't.
They have
although
laws.
Actually you could, but you just couldn't call the wine Bordeaux. Mm-hmm. So there's enough of a monetary reward for calling your wine Bordeaux that nobody takes that chance.
Well, Florence, you said in California they grow every grape under the sun. I'm thinking a lot about climate change and whether we're going to start seeing all sorts of changes on where different grapes grow.
It's possible.
I understand they're making wines in England, aren't they?
Denmark.
I think you see in England the effect of climate change. England, the south of England, has the very same soil that they do in Champagne. Those are the white cliffs of Dover. It's chalk, like in Champagne. But it was always too cold to ripen the grapes, and now they can do it, and they make really good sparkling wines there.
We don't have much time left, but I want to mention some of the other recipes you have. You've linked, Florence, Barbera with fettuccine with mushroom ragu using cremini's and tomato paste. Malbec with chimichurri hanger steak.
Well, classic. That's your Argentine. Yeah. Some of the recipes are regional matchings that make sense also.
Lambrusco with baby back ribs. And how did you come up with your braised pork roast with olives? You use a Dutch oven at very low heat.
Yeah.
Dutch oven, is that because you can kind of slow cook when
yeah.
you're in
well,
a Dutch oven?
That's what you want with a – you want to braise is with not a whole lot of liquid and slow heat that breaks down the fibers and the gelatin in the meat and makes it tender.
There are also desserts. You
a
have
few.
A fortified chocolate cake. Fortified in what way?
Fortified. I think this one, I don't recall whether
it probably
it's,
goes with a fortified wine.
Yeah, it whether it's got port in it or I've also made that same cake with scotch.
Well, can you explain fortified wines?
Yeah. Fortified wines have neutral spirits added to them, and this stabilizes the wine and makes it a little bit more powerful. In the case of Madeira and Port, you know, these are among the most stable wines in the world. You have Madeiras that go back centuries, and they're still good to drink.
Are they more alcoholic?
Absolutely. Yeah. They're probably around 20% or so as opposed to the usual 13 to 14% for table wines.
The cake
today.
Has got Madeira in it. And my understanding is that they fortified the wine so that they wouldn't spoil on an ocean trip from Portugal or Madeira Island or Spain.
And I gather that in the old days of the sailing ships, the rolling of the barrels on the because the ships were going back and forth it made the improved the wine and they felt that these wines were better when they arrived in the recently developed United States than they were back home
or England.
The founding fathers were happy.
Well, the founding fathers probably would be even more happy today because they'd have a lot more choices. Thomas Jefferson wouldn't just have to drink Bordeaux. So
well, they would recognize that the Madeira that they liked is now available again after a long absence, and that's a good thing.
Eric Asimov, Florence Fabricant, their book Wine with Food, Pairing Notes and Recipes from the New York Times, published by Rizzoli. And I want to thank you so much for being on our show again.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thank
this
you.
Is great.